You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore, and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we are the lead-out men, Lionel, aren't we? The engines in the lead-out train for Adam Blythe and Owain Doull, who is actually quite a decent sprinter, so that sort of works. The fifth episode of Adam Blythe interviews, and he's chatting today to Team Sky rider Owain Doull. Welshman, a gold medalist at the Rio Olympics in the team pursuit, who's been focusing on the road since then, and was second in Kerner Brussels Kerner earlier this year behind Bob Jungels, which was a very good result, probably his best result as a professional on the road. So interested to hear their chat in a cafe near to where they live in Cheshire. So we'll cross over to Adam Blythe in a moment, then Lionel and I will return at the end to discuss some of the points that came up in their conversation, perhaps also a little chat, Lionel, about Team Sky and their pretty poor start to the year. I mean, Owain Doull's second place at Kerner Brussels Kerner is actually one of their best results of the early part of the season. But before we do cross over to Adam Blythe, I must say a big thank you to Rafa, the headline sponsor for all cycling podcast productions. And I must tell you about the new Core Cargo bib shorts. These are Rafa's entry level shorts, which have been updated to offer everything you need for every day on the bike. They allow you to carry more whatever the style of riding, featuring the same and hugely popular pockets on the legs and back, which were first introduced on the Explorer collection. So whether it's a spare gel on a mountain effort or a camera on a weekend adventure, carry more of the things that turn rides into memories. Also check out rafa.cc for the shorts and for the EF Gone Racing films, which will be released throughout the year. Quite a few of those already there. And subscribe to Rafa on YouTube to get all the EF Gone Racing films. But without further ado, let's cross over to a cafe somewhere in Cheshire and hear from Adam Blythe in conversation with Owain Doull.
You are listening to a special episode of the Cycling Podcast. Adam Blythe interviews.
Right, we're on. So today, here with me is Owain Doull. How you doing, mate? Sorry, I've got to pass the microphone to him. Instead of just introducing him, I'm going to ask him a question first. Here we are, Wilmslow, where we both live now. You moved back from France last year. How is it? You enjoying it? Enjoying the sunny Manchester weather? Saying that, you lived here before, so sort of normal, innit?
Yeah, so back in Manchester. Lived here for 4 years, when I was 18 to 22 doing the track stuff. And then for the last kind of 2 years being between Nice and Cardiff. And made the decision to move back up north. It's good. You can't fault it, really. I think the roads are good, the training group's good. And I think, it just works for me better.
Rosé lifestyle in France got too much of you, mate. I reckon that's what it is, like me. So, back in Manchester now, training full time. Got me and Stannard, Lawless as well, who don't come out much, but yeah, he's around to train with. So life's going good. Back from Sun Tour, first win. Back from Provence as well, which we were just talking about. We'll move on to that. But Sun Tour, how was it after getting your first win? And also, many people are questioning, did Luke give it you?
Yes, absolutely buzzing coming back from Sun Tour, obviously. Takes a lot of work starting that early in the year, and it means you kind of have to look after yourself in your off season and start up pretty early. But after getting that win, it was kind of all worth it. And yeah, in terms of Luke giving it to me, I think it was a really good day. I think it was a combination of a couple of things. You know, we both obviously made that move. I jumped first, got away, and then Luke kind of sat on the group behind, managed to jump across. I waited for him. And then as soon as he got on, started tramming it again, we were off. And the first thing Luke said was, mate, you can have it. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not going to say no to that. But I think that's just a sign of how classy Luke is as a guy. Obviously, he knows that will mean a lot more to me than it will for him. I'll make a bigger difference for me next year. than it would for him as well. And also, you know, a little act like that, I'll give him that back 10 times in the classics. So I think it all kind of evens itself out.
You say that, mate. What if you and him are in the velodrome together? It's going to happen. You're just going to turn around and be like, ah, mate, you know, that win. Change your mind. But no, it's good to see you, mate. And obviously you've been back here, trained a little bit this winter. And, you know, for me, you seem to have changed a bit as a person. I mean, not in a bad way, in a good way, that you got a lot more professional this winter than, you know, you were when you lived here 2-3 years ago when you're on the Olympics. Obviously, it was a bit different than you just doing that, the track stuff, which is a lot different. You had a lot more spare time on your hands, whereas now you're on it, you're not drinking.
Yeah, I think, like you say, I guess it's kind of just like that progression of growing up and just learning and fine-tuning what the right things to do for you are. And I think those first couple of years with Sky, you kind of get a little bit lost and you don't quite know which direction you need to go in and what stuff's important for you to work on. And it's that kind of accumulation of figuring stuff out on your own and making those mistakes, and then that kind of brings you back to where you need to do. And, you know, part of that was moving back to Manchester and just kind of realizing, you know, obviously you have a talent for this kind of stuff, and it's kind of about making the most of what you have and the abilities you have. I'm not wasting the time you have doing it, to be honest. So for me, I kind of just sat down at the end of the year and worked out what I wanted to do, what I wanted to achieve, and what factors there were which was going to change to make that happen. So yeah, the main thing now is focusing on the classics and being good there and carrying on the progression from last year, and then trying to break into the team's bigger kind of stage racing squads. So I'm trying to get a Grand Tour under my belt with the team this year.
And quite a simple question, those things that you wanted to change, are they big things or are they just little things? And, you know, going back to Sky, when you first sort of joined, when you're Olympic champ, straight out of the bag and then straight into Sky, was it all you expected Sky to be? I mean, it's probably the best team in the world for how professional it is. And I think every team sort of aspires to be like them. You know, everyone's looking at marginal gains, this, that and the other now. But is it what it looks like from the outside? Cause, you know, everyone knows who's in pro cycling knows what it's like. But for you as a neo-pro coming off the Olympics and that super structured track program, was it a lot different? Is it a lot more serious? Is it a lot more structured? And like I said, what were the things you had to change this year that you sat down and looked at?
Yeah, I know, we're getting real serious. I was sold this podcast as a light-hearted chat over a coffee. It was kind of a lot of stuff I expected and a lot of stuff I didn't really. You know, I think my first year with the team was a real shock for me. I think I had my appendicitis. I was out in Down Under for the first race of the year. My appendix ruptured and I ended up spending a week in hospital out there. And then I had blood poisoning when I got back, and that kind of derailed my first year with the team. And yeah, I think it was a big shock going from the Olympic stuff where you have such a focus on just literally one day and that's all that matters in your 4 years. As if you're good for the games, you're good and everything's perfect, you know. Whereas when you do the road, you have to be good consistently every single day. And there were points in my first year with the team where some days I was really good and kind of doing what the team expected of me, and then there were some days where I was just off a cliff and nowhere near where I had to be at. And it's all about eking out that consistency over a year and being dependable and reliable, especially on a team like Sky, where every race you go to, you have a job to do. You're told a week in advance what your job's going to do. They know what to expect of you, and you have to deliver. And I think that's something I've tried to work on this year. One of the things I sat down with a coach and thought about trying to do was get that consistency in, so that every day I could perform and just be dependable.
I think that's the thing with cycling these days, especially when you're a pro, you can never really be bad anymore. You always got to be good. You know, like, you go to every race, you know what it's like these days. If you don't do well, you might be kicked out the next race because someone's always going a little bit better than you. So I think for me, it's just hard to try and stay on top of it. You know, you'd like try and do, say if you did Down Under, you're going super well there, you try to peak, and then after that you've got to try and hold on to that form and then build again for the classics. And I think that's the thing with cycling now. It's not really, you have to hit your massive peaks, but you'd never really get your lows anymore. You always have to stay on that sort of level that is just a little bit below really, really, really good. And I think that's what's harder than it was, you know, 5 years ago about pro cycling. So throwing it back a little bit, mate, before all this happened in your Olympic champ, you were on the academy for a little bit in 2012. We just spoke about that earlier. And then on to Ampost. I mean, a lot of guys did that, but the academy used to like feed people into, you know, into Sky or whatever, and then you went away, went to Ampost, and then came back and wrote for Wiggins, I think it was. How did all that come around, you know, from going on the academy? You'd got a lot of medals on the track. You're a European champ, never a world champ, which I'll ask you about in a bit. But is that, you know, was that, you think, the right path for you, or do you think you should have stayed on the track for longer and not gone to Ampost and, you know, that kind of direction?
Yeah, so I think, obviously, yeah, I got into the academy the first time in 2012. That was all good. And then I was kind of progressing through the road stuff with Ampost, GB as well, you know, Tour Britain and stuff. And then I think it would have been that 2014 year, I think the academy race program was looking a little bit more limited. And I'd been kind of going better on the road and kind of starting to think more of that. I was also a career at first. I think when I first got on, I took a massive kicking in my first year on the road, and kind of just thought, okay, the track's for me. I'll just be like like Berkey or Ed, you know, just like have that kind of track career and just focus on that. I was like, nah, the road's not for me. I don't have what it is. And then I kind of just knuckled down, carried on working. Second year, I got better, and you know, no crazy results, nothing like, this guy's definitely going to turn pro, but just enough to make me think, I could give this a nudge. And I decided then to reach out to Kurt Bogarts, Kurt, who's an absolute legend, to be fair to him, and try and join Ampost. And it actually happened at a really good time for me, because that year we had the Cali World Champs, and it was a shit show. Absolute shit show. Like the training was off, everything wasn't right, and I don't think as a group we weren't super professional, we didn't have the best build up ever, but it wasn't anything crazy. And you know, I remember afterwards in the papers and stuff, everyone saying, oh, you know, the younger guys were all pissheads and stuff, but that just generally wasn't the truth. And so we did that, and there was a bit of backlash after that from the program, and you know, talking like probation and potentially getting kicked off and stuff like that. And at that stage, I just thought, you know what, I've committed to the track here, I've put a lot in, I've worked hard, we've gone to a world's kind of underpaired, we didn't quite get it right, it was at altitude, and we didn't perform. And it wasn't just us young guys, you know, me, John Dibb and Sam Harrison, it was like, you had guys who had been, you had two world champions, an Olympic champion in Berkey and Tennant, who didn't even make selection. So, you know, it was just a bad experience all around. We kind of went away from that, and I remember bit of backlash and, you know, being under review and stuff, and I just thought, stuff this, I want to go away, I'm going to go move to Belgium, I'm going to focus on the road and get my head down, I'm going to forget all about this kind of stuff. So I went to Belgium my first year, and pretty much straight out of the blocks, one of the first races I did was Triptyque Montchateau, which is a really big stage race for under 23s in Belgium. I think my past winners are like Heyman, Boonen, a lot of the classics guys. It was a big race, and straight out of the blocks there, won a stage, won the overall, fourth at U23 Flanders, and it's kind of just all started coming together, the roadside of stuff. And at that stage, I was thinking, right, I'm just going to stop the track. There's just too much, you know, I'm not happy with how it's going, I'm obviously not good enough. But then that year, we also had the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, and obviously it's a big thing to compete for Wales, and I thought, okay, I'm gonna give the Commonwealth Games a crack, and I'm going to try and prove a point here. And I remember I got taken off. I had like a UKSI bike, you know, one of the superhero fast ones. They took that away from me. They put me back on a normal Pinarello. And I remember turning up to there, and I think in the IP straight away, I qualified third, beat all the other British lads on my slower bike riding for Wales. And kind of did a pretty fast time. And that's when I kind of started thinking again, I do actually have what it takes for the track side of stuff. And then from there, the opportunity then came around with Wiggins to join their program. You know, I spoke, obviously it was good because Brad was obviously in it, and also my agent at the time, Andrew McQuaid, was the team manager, and he said, this is going to be the idea, the structure, you know, we'll support you for your road stuff so you can do that, and we'll also support you for the Olympic side of stuff. Then joined Wiggins, had a really good year with them on the road, like across UCI races, won like a lot of races in like 2.2s, 1.2s, and then obviously that culminated in third overall at Tour Britain and the points jersey and everything which come with that. And that then led to my Sky contract. They were kind of keen to sign me for the season straight away, so the Olympic year 16, but they were really good with me, that they said, you can hold off. I wanted to hold off a year because I thought I don't want to compromise anything for the Olympics. You know, I've worked so hard to be in that position that the perfect route for me is to stay with Wiggins. So they were really good with me that they said you can almost like defer for a year. You can sign the contract now, but you won't join the team till after the games, which I did. And then, yeah, now I'm here at Sky. That's quite a waffle there, but it was a bit of a roundup.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by DNA Fit, who provide genetically guided fitness and nutrition insights for training solutions and long-term health benefits. DNA Fit has helped 50,000 people unlock their health potential through genetically personalized fitness and nutrition insights. Richard, you're the 50,001st DNA Fit customer, I gather. We've been talking about the results of your tests, but the one that I've been looking forward to most is to hear the experts talk about your response to alcohol and caffeine. I may have some insights on that from travelling around the Grand Tours with you.
Yeah, well, last week we heard, of course, from Tom Lancashire, the Olympic middle distance runner, who is my consultant at DNA Fit, that I could and should have been Chris Hoy. If I'd focused on track sprinting as a teenager, we would never have heard of Chris Hoy, he kind of said. But we also looked at what else my DNA test seemed to indicate in terms of my capacity to increase my VO2, my ability to recover from training and susceptibility to injury. And we looked at diet and any intolerances I might have. It also told me, as you say, about my response to alcohol and caffeine. And I was very interested in this. So here's Tom Lancashire again.
So with this, basically, we've found that alcohol can have a positive effect on your HDL cholesterol, which is good, but it's more of an effect for some people than others, and you fall into that group where there is an increased benefit from alcohol. Obviously, our advice doesn't change, even if you're, you know, there's no, if there is a benefit, if there isn't, we still say if you're going to drink in moderation.
This is wonderful news.
Well, what we tend to see as well, I don't know if this fits with your experience, but if you're a slower metabolizer like yourself, it actually means that you tend to get drunk more quickly because the alcohol's pooling in your bloodstream. You're not breaking down as quickly as you're consuming it. Generally speaking, slower metabolizers actually get drunk a little bit more quickly. Mm. What about caffeine? Do you drink much coffee or tea at all?
I do, yeah. I do drink quite a lot of coffee, yeah.
Okay. Well, it's good news in a sense. Basically, you're a fast metabolizer, which means the risks associated with excessive caffeine intake are reduced for you. Obviously, drinking 15 cups a day isn't healthy, but good news for people who like coffee, basically.
Great.
And I don't know if you
I'm going to go and celebrate with a cup of coffee and a glass of wine.
Yeah. Well, it may be like a, what do you call it, an espresso martini or something. Just get it both in one go.
Yeah, an Irish, Irish coffee, yeah.
So very encouraging news there, Lionel. It shouldn't affect our grand tours too much.
Oh, how did I know you'd be an expert responder to those two substances?
Yep, as I said there, I went and celebrated with an Irish coffee. no, I didn't. But there is a disclaimer. Your genetic makeup is only one part of the picture. It is not a method of prediction or of identifying talent. DNA Fit focus on a personalized approach to your training and nutrition, giving you the tools to reach your goals. Genetically matched meal and exercise plans. Genetically matched meal and exercise plans give you the guidance to determine fact from fiction when it comes to fad diets or trendy exercises. DNA Fit is a market leader, helping people unlock their health potential through genetically personalized fitness and nutrition insights. I've actually signed up to the fitness program, so you get a daily email with your plan for the day, and also the meal plan as well. The Mediterranean diet is the one that's been recommended for me, which is good news, of course. So yeah, really a really interesting little exercise. Very easy to send off the swab with my DNA taken from the gums in my mouth and get the results back. And yes, it's been an interesting little voyage of discovery for me.
DNA Fit has robust science behind it. Every gene they look at has at least 3 peer-reviewed studies on human subjects. And in 2016, they released the world's first genetic exercise intervention-based study, showing that you can discover what kind of exercise works best for you. DNA Fit are offering 20% off to our listeners. So start your personalized health journey today by heading to dnafit.com/TCP. to access the discount code and discover more. That's dnafit.com/TCP for the Cycling Podcast.
Well, also sponsoring this episode of the Cycling Podcast is the London to Brighton Bike Ride, which supports the British Heart Foundation. That is on the 16th of June this year, which is also Father's Day, but you and I, Lionel, have been given the day off, or perhaps a Father's Day treat, to ride in our Cycling Podcast team. It starts at Clapham Common and finishes, of course, in Brighton on the beach, where there's food and drink, including a bar, live acts, massages, and much more. The event is the oldest and best charity bike ride in Europe. It's 44 years old this year, and anyone who's age 14 or over can take part. Under 16s must be accompanied by an adult. The adult entry fee is £45. Under 18 entry fee is £40. It's a fantastic route, and the famous hill towards the end is, of course, Ditchling Beacon. You can get £5 off with the code Brighton5. That's Brighton5 for £5 off. And as I mentioned there, Lionel, that we are entering a Cycling Podcast team. That makes it sound competitive. It isn't, very much is not competitive, but we're really looking forward to that. You, me, Rose Manley, and some of our producers.
Yeah, it's going to be a great day, isn't it? Hopefully the weather will be good. The route will be challenging enough, I think, for certainly for me, I think, at the moment. 54 miles long, 17 miles of it are on completely closed roads. Ditchling Beacon is no picnic, but we'll be saving our picnic for the beach anyway, won't we, when we've finished. But it's a real sociable event. And as I've said previously, I rode it in 1990 when I was 14. And my plan is to dig out my 1990 bike, which I had restored a couple of years ago. I need to check out that it's going to stand up to the rigours of carrying me to the coast. Hopefully it will. But either way, whatever I'm riding, I will be there. And you can be too, listeners, if you sign up at bhf.org.uk/L2B2019. Enter the code Brighton5, that's Brighton and the number 5, and you'll get £5 off your entry. Or if you'd like to sponsor the Cycling Podcast, because we'd love to raise as much money as we can for the British Heart Foundation, because they do fantastic research and support, go to justgiving.com/the-cycling-podcast. We're hoping to raise a good few £1,000 for the British Heart Foundation.
I forgot about this. Didn't you get offered as well after your Ampos years a contract with Direct Energy? Yeah. Do you look back at it and think, could have been speaking French by now, could have been eating snails, mate, but is that not something then, you know, you were still, I think that was the time where you were sort of unsure about the track still, where you're just thinking, well, this is a chance here, I can go for it. And did, I know McQuaidie's my agent as well, did he advise you to say, no, you shouldn't do it, or was it just you off your own back sort of going, nah, sack it, I don't want to be in a French team?
Yeah, Direct Energy, dodged a bullet there, didn't I? Like back then, to be fair, it was actually under Europcar, I think it was the name of it. It was Europcar, and they were still World Tour at the time. So obviously a World Tour offer and stuff is quite a big thing. And I was third year U23, so I had 1 year left. And in my head, I was thinking, oh, you only have all the good guys turn pro after 3 years or 2 years. No one's that good after 4 years. No one gets a good contract after 4 years. You're kind of like last chance saloon. It's really hard to do. So I was pretty set on it, and I was really I'm an R and about it, obviously a big move, and I didn't know how they'd fit in with my track commitments and what I wanted to do on the track and the games. And then fortunately, yeah, the whole Wigan thing came around. So yeah, I spoke to McQuaid, and yeah, just probably the best decision I ever made, because, you know, obviously that led to me then still being massively involved with the track stuff, the flexibility to do all the altitude camps, all the World Cups, and then yeah, in the end it led to an Olympic gold medal on my contract with Sky. And that first year with Wiggins, when I was kind of road focused as well, was just such a great year. Just really loving racing and getting results. And yeah, kind of one of the best decisions I made was staying U23 for a longer year. And I think you just learn a lot when you at that level. You just learn how to race smart and win. And yeah, it was a really important year for me.
Looking forward to your future, you got, we spoke earlier saying about the world's medals. You've got two medals in the elite road, I think, have you? You've got the team time trial, bronze. That's it, innit? In the elite, yeah. And the road. But you've never been a world champ on the track either. Olympics next year, mate. You're looking to get back on the track. You're thinking, maybe I'll have a little sniff at that. that Olympic gold again or not? And, you know, before that, you got all the worlds and a build-up to it. Is that something you're thinking of, or you're fully set on the road now and trying to make a career out of you? You are doing that already, but trying to, you know, commit everything into road rather than look back on the track like a lot of riders do, you know. People like Elia especially, he jumps back on the track. Are you looking to do that, or are you looking at just full commitment for the road?
I think that's the thing with track and road. You kind of look at it and you think it's either how you want to be remembered in terms of your career in the cycling world or in the UK kind of sporting world. And if it's important, the UK kind of stuff, then the track is everything, because, you know, it's Olympic gold medals, it's games after games after games, that repetitive side of it. Whereas in the cycling world, you know, especially on the road, there's so much more you can do. And I think for now, I think I've done the track once, I've kind of got that medal in my pocket and everything which went with it. And I feel that if I went back to the track, it would pretty much take a year out of what I did on the road. And I feel that was a massive difference for me. Like, I had my 2015 was really good on the road. I was, like I said, you know, third at Britain and really up there in high caliber races. And then 16, I think I did maybe 20 or 30 race days, just full commitment for the track. And obviously it went really well, you know, obviously Rio gold medal, world record, you can't ask for much more. But that then knocked into my next year, my first year with the team. I hadn't raced as much on the road. I hadn't done as many miles. And I think it really impacted on my first year with the team. And I think it was the same actually for Elia. If you look at Elia, he did similar, you know, that full focus in 16 on the Olympics. And then the start of 17, he wasn't actually that good. And then he really started to pick up towards the back end of 17. But at the start, he was really struggling. And I think if you go back to the track, especially this day and age of how fast and how powerful and the commitment it takes, that it's pretty much you take a step back on the road, I think. And, you know, I already turned kind of pro, as it were, relatively late at 23, because obviously I'd decided to defer the road stuff for a year and focus on the track, that I kind of just want to crack on with the road now, and I feel like I'm behind where I should be for my years. So yeah, as much as I'd love to go back for the track, I don't think it's feasible. If I could do the marathon and try to drop back in for that, I'd love to, but obviously the team pursuit is the focus and the most important thing, and it's just whether that would work around that, but I doubt it. So I'm kind of just for now focusing on the road and thinking about that. One thing I feel very grateful for this year though is that I still have a team and I still have a contract and opportunity to race. You know, there's a lot of good bike riders who've been flicked this year. It's actually bonkers. You know, there's, you know, someone like a good mate of mine, Dibbo, John Dibbon, no contract. You know, he'd won a World Tour time trial the year before, and then had a bit of an off year and broke his elbow and stuff, and all of a sudden he's forgotten about and gone. Almost overnight he then becomes a shit bike rider, when in reality he still has a lot of talent. He's still a young guy. You know, other guys, you know, same someone like Scott Thwaites, you know, someone who's been top 10 in Strada Bianchi, and I think Hauerbecker as well, and all of a sudden he's having to drop down two levels. It's just crazy. Mark Christian, he's another one, like another good mate of mine. And you know, yeah, it's just crazy, and when you see stuff like that, you kind of brings it home that I'm very grateful to have a contract and still be racing and have the platform to try and do the most of it. I think that was one of the big things which kind of made me change, not my attitude overall, but just kind of start thinking about everything even more and more. And kind of, before the Olympics, I kind of, that year I had a kind of like a laser-like focus. Everything I did was towards the Olympics, and I wasn't going to compromise anything. I wasn't going to get to the Games, and if we came second, stand there and think, I could have done this, I could have done this, I could have done this. I wanted everything ticked off, and if I got there and we lost, then fair play to whoever beat us, because they're better. But I didn't want that excuse. And kind of those 2 years after, I was still really focused and on it, but I didn't quite have that laser-like focus which I had before. And I think after last year, and seeing like a lot of your mates kind of drop down levels and really struggle for jobs and that kind of uncertainty, that kind of changed something in my head, and just thought, right, I'm lucky to be here. I've got a good opportunity. I'm in the best team in the world. I have a talent for this. I need to get the most out of it and make the most of my abilities and the time I have. So that just led on to trying to be more professional in everything I do. So,
mad world, isn't it? Pro cycling. I think, you know, I'm a cat with nine lives. Somehow I've got another contract. But yeah, it's it's not as glamorous as it all seems. And I think that's what people forget in cycling, is that, you know, you go from, like you say, Dibben winning a world tour, thinking he's Neo as a Neo pro, and then now just being sort of left. But I think it sort of backs it up that you just say cycling's getting more sort of serious now, and if you're not good 90% of the time, that can leave you without a job. And, you know, God knows what, if I'd have not got a job this year, then I'd have just been bin man or something, you know. You just don't know. So yeah, I guess it does strike home, and it's good that, you know, you've got a mature head on your shoulders, which is good, mate. You just need to find a wife now, mate, and have some kids. You'd be loving life. Right, cheers, mate. Thanks for coming.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast throughout the year. And you can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. Thanks to Science in Sport. And somebody who consumes a lot of Science in Sport products will be Owain Doole, because Science in Sport supply Team Sky. And that was an interesting chat, I thought. What was interesting for me about this latest interview in the Adam Blythe series was the sort of slightly different dynamics I felt between Adam and Owain, because Adam was the sort of senior rider. Last week we heard him in conversation with Tim Harris, who's been his mentor for a few years, and it was almost as though Adam was mentor in a way to Owain Doole. I felt like he was sort of subtly passing on a few lessons, a few tips that he's learned. They've followed a similar journey in a way, having, you know, Adam spent a few years in living in Monaco, living the high life in Monaco, and then has moved back to the UK where he's sort of settled down and he's now got three kids. And Owain Doole, at a much younger age, has also lived in that sort of area, south of France, and has also returned back to the UK. And the sort of certainly Adam has also obviously picked up that Doole has buckled down a bit in the final year of his Team Sky contract. It's contract year for him, and important that he gets some good results to secure his future.
Yeah, I mean, Owain Doole, much more of a product of the British cycling pathway, though, than Adam Blythe. But it must be, you know, must be difficult when you win an Olympic medal, an Olympic gold medal. What age would Owain Doole have been when he won that medal? Was he 22?
He's 25. So 23, yeah,
when they won in Rio. And that this kind of, I remember Bradley Wiggins talking about this when, you know, when he won Olympic medals, thinking that it was going to be sort of transformative for his entire life, and that, you know, he'd never have to work again, or whatever the ideas were prior to winning an Olympic gold. Perhaps when you're an active sportsman or sportswoman, particularly in cycling where road racing is your bread and butter, there's almost a kind of a delayed reward to the Olympic medal. It kind of gets put on the shelf as obviously a fantastic achievement, but there's a big contrast between being an Olympic gold medalist and being the sort of rider that Owain Doole, you know, the sort of role he fills in Team Sky, because he isn't, he's rarely the kind of the going to be the protected rider, certainly in the biggest races. And I think that's what made the Brussels-Kerner result stand out, because although the victory had kind of disappeared up the road in those closing kilometres, you know, Bob Jungels wasn't going to get caught, was he? Although it was pretty close as they came into the finishing straight. You know, Doole saw an opportunity there and seized it, really went for it. And, you know, that, as you said, Rich, at the start, that probably is Team Sky's standout result of the Cobble Classics.
It is. I mean, he was given an opportunity as well a couple of weeks later in E3, which he wasn't able to take, really. Didn't have the legs on that day. But, you know, it's his third year with Team Sky. He hasn't ridden a Grand Tour yet. He said there that he's keen to ride a Grand Tour this year. That would probably make a big difference to him, maybe physically as well. But, you know, he's one of a crop of young British riders who joined Team Sky two or three years ago. Teo Gegenhart was another, but John Dibben was another. And John Dibben wasn't kept on this year. He wasn't offered a new contract. So that will have been a warning to Doole and the others, I suppose, that you know, there are no guarantees that just because you're a talented young British rider, there isn't necessarily a big contract waiting for you at Team Sky. You'll be kept on results alone and I guess attitude and potential as well. So it's a big year for him, and you know, he's a talented rider. You know, he's mentioned some of his results as an under 23 rider, third on GC at the Tour of Britain in 2015 as well, was a really standout result. And one comment he made in passing, which really made me sort of sit up, was about the offer he had from Direct Energy a few years ago, which would have taken him in a completely different direction to France and a very French team, where he might have been a sort of, I don't know, Brian Coquard type sprinter, perhaps. That might have been the way that they would have seen him developing. And he just said in passing, dodged the bullet there. I'm not quite sure what he really meant by that, but he clearly feels that, you know, he obviously not going there meant that he was able to go to the Olympics and win a gold medal, which is something he'll always have, obviously, and, you know, begin his professional career with Team Sky. So, you know, but it is a big year for him. At 25, and in the third year of his contract with Team Sky, it's a really, really pivotal year for him to, you know, move on into the next phase of his career and start getting some more results, because he's clearly capable of it. He's a fast finisher as well, and we often talk about, you know, how fast a fast rider can do very well for himself, because that's what teams are looking for. They're looking for guys who can finish. And
it always reminds me of Dave Brailsford saying that, you know, nationality is not going to be, offer any guarantees in Team Sky. Being a British rider might open a door, but really it's part of being part of the British system that kind of funnels talent towards Team Sky. And but being British is not enough. And I think, you know, when you think of, just off the top of my head, Andy Fenn, for example, to a degree, Pete Kennock, who's obviously moved away to Bora Hansgrohe and is currently taking a break from racing. But others, you know, Alex Peters, who left Team Sky and you know, it didn't progress on. There's no guarantees. And going from Team Sky or Ineos, as it will be, to a foreign team would be a big culture change and a big difference in the way of working, and just everything about it would be different. So I'm not surprised that Dool has perhaps his focus slightly.
Speaking of focus, Lionel, I do apologise for the slight the gentle piano playing in the background. It's probably a sign that we should wrap things up. We did hear in the background in the cafe there were one or two baby noises. My 2 year old boy has just arrived home and he's playing the piano.
This is
which could
is
be
this
worse.
Our new theme music, Rich? Is that?
I don't know. We need to check. We've got copyright on this, but we don't want to be paying any royalties. But it probably does mean that we should wrap
Indeed.
Things up. He's wanting some attention, clearly. So that's all for the penultimate Adam Blythe interview. Still don't know who we're getting next week, do we?
No, not that I'm really chilled out.
It's keeping us on
really
tenterhooks.
Chilled out about this. Yeah, I just know that Adam Blythe will deliver when it really matters.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're very confident in that. But Adam, if you're listening, I'm sure you will be. Let us know soon. Anyway, that's all for now. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thanks to Adam Blythe and Owen Dool.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.
Lee. League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Save big at Menards and prepare for the summer heat with a new air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Cool your space from anywhere in the room with three cooling speeds and a remote control. Save big money on Denali Air air conditioners. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.